noticed I was falling just a little bit before getting up. I was all geared up to sing a couple of songs there. So, you know, it's hard to get that just right. Because back home at Hansville, one time I just jumped up there and got ready to preach, and the song leader looked at me like, you know, he wasn't ready for me. I was just so eager to get up there, and we had more songs, so I was up in the pulpit. That didn't work too smoothly. So here I was hesitating because I thought, well, we're going to have some songs first. Brian, this class period goes till what? 45? 10:15. Well, I better get started then. As has been announced, our topic this morning is on the role of husbands and fathers. We studied last night about the Proverbs, from the Proverbs, as we said that a house by wisdom, a house is built. And so many of the Proverbs are talking about the home. Proverbs 18, verse 22, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. And it's a good thing because it's good for the man to have suitable companionship. God saw, I'm revisiting some things we mentioned last evening, but God saw, it's not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. And so, as we said last evening, God is the one who designed marriage, not man. And it was designed, among other things, so that man would have someone to share with him in the joys as well as sorrows of life, someone with whom he can confide, in someone that will be his constant helper. Proverbs, again, another text from the Proverbs. Proverbs 19:14, houses and riches are an inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. And we've already made several references to Proverbs 31, a worthy woman who can find. Her price is far above rubies. And so that wonderful woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. The wonderful qualities, indeed, her husband rises, and he praises her. We have also considered Jesus' teaching regarding marriage and the permanency of marriage, as well as answering questions about divorce. In Matthew 19, verse 5 and 6, Jesus was asked a question, really about divorce, but he said, have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. You're asking about divorce, but Jesus said, so then they are no longer two, but one flesh. And he then concluded, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. We've raised the question, what are you attracted to? As we've talked about preparation, for marriage, we've referenced Proverbs 11:22 as a ring of gold and a swine's snout. So is a lovely woman who lacks discretion. Isn't that some more word picture? And if this does not speak well of the woman who is beautiful on the outside but lacking spiritual qualities, lacking godliness on the inside, what does it say about a man if this is what he's attracted to? It certainly doesn't speak well of the woman, but it doesn't speak well of the man. We've also pointed out, and again I say this in the passing, because as we consider the role of husbands and fathers, this is important to bear in mind. And that is to recognize not everyone is eligible for marriage. And so as the home is being built, to recognize that not everyone can marry. The Bible teaches that one who has never been married is eligible for marriage. The passage we just noted in Matthew 19, verse 4 and 5 would have to do with that. And in Hebrews 13, verse 4, let marriage be held in honor among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God shall judge. So again, the man leaving father and mother, cleaving to his wife, this is blessed by the Lord. And those who have never been married are obviously eligible for marriage. But also, Romans 7 teaches that when one's spouse has died, that the surviving party is free to marry. And in the third place, as we noticed last evening, one who has divorced his wife for the cause of fornication. That's the singular exception Jesus gives. When there's been a marriage and one puts away his spouse for the cause of fornication, that the subsequent marriage then would not be adultery. But otherwise, when one marries except for that cause, divorces and remarries except for that cause, Jesus says he or she commits adultery. A fourth category, as we mentioned last evening, that would be eligible for marriage is when there has been a separation, when there's been a divorce, and the two parties that were joined by God who have been separated, when the two parties are being reconciled one to another. And this is what the Bible teaches so far as who is free to marry. And so make sure, as you make your plans, as you think in terms of your status before God, that you are in keeping with His will. His word is that which will judge us on the last day. Jesus said, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall never pass away." Jesus said in John 12, verse 48, "He that rejecteth me and receiveth not these sayings of mine hath one that judgeth him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day." So we've got, when I think in terms of these lessons about the home, we have small children here. We have young people here. We have young people here that are of an age that it would be appropriate for courtship to occur. We have others that are not quite there yet, but the Lord willing will be. We have others that have been married for years. Linda and I, incidentally, in case you're wondering, we have been married for 43 years. The Lord willing, this June will make 44 years. So some have been married many years. Some are not married yet. Some are married fewer years. And so here we are talking about the role of husbands, and in the next period, the role of wives. But my point is, this lesson is for you. Wherever you are, you need to know God's word yourself. You need to be able to teach His word to others and make sure you're in compliance with it. If you're already a husband, then use these passages to be a better husband. If you're not a husband yet, then look at these verses and see what God has in mind for you. And so in that sense, I trust there's application for all. I've made the point before, and without trying to be repetitious, I know we're trying to build on principles, and we're reminding you of some things that have been said, and that is that you don't compartmentalize your life before God. A living sacrifice, one that says, "Speak, Lord, thy servant heareth," the point is, in all of life, there is to be submission to the Lord. And so sometimes I just make this point, that what produces Christians, what makes strong Christians, will make good husbands and will make good wives. It'll make good fathers and make good mothers. And what we're talking about that makes strong Christians goes back to that basic commitment to Christ. Loving the Lord with all of our heart, seeking to do His will, wanting to be more and more like Jesus, being molded by His word. Colossians 3:16, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly." In Luke 6 and verse 40, "The disciple is not above his master, but everyone who has been fully trained will be like his teacher, more and more like Jesus." And so when that's our spirit, when that's our attitude, when we're just wanting to know His will, we delight in doing His will because we love the Lord, what happens is a lot of good things are a byproduct of that. And one is it makes the home as God would have it. But if we don't have that Christ-centered life that, for example, Colossians 3 talks about, it's not going to work out well. You could attend marriage seminars, you could read books by good authors on the home, but something's lacking if the foundation is not there. I'm going to just look at a couple of key thoughts in Colossians 3. Would you turn there with me in your New Testaments? Colossians chapter 3. You know, I'm thinking, last evening I talked about James 1 where it says, "If any of you lack wisdom," and I talked about the way the word "if" was used there, when it's a presupposition that the reader will say, "Well, yes, that's me, I need wisdom." And I could say this about Colossians 3 and verse 1, the way that starts out. If you then were raised with Christ, well, he doesn't mean, I'm not sure if you were or not, but if you were. It's if in the sense of since you were, here's what follows. How do I know that they were raised with Christ? Well, we turn back to Colossians 2. In Colossians 2, it says in verse 12 that these readers, he says, were buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the working of God. And so he talks about what happens at scriptural baptism, that one is forgiven, as verse 13 says. He was dead in his trespasses and sins, but he says, you he has made alive together with him, having forgiven you having forgiven you all trespasses. What a difference the gospel makes. So you were in sin. You were dead in sin. Now you're alive. What happened? Well, you were buried. See, we bury dead people. And so you were buried, but you were raised. And you were raised, as Romans 6 would say, to walk in newness of life. So he's already established that in Colossians 2, that these recipients of this letter, they had been buried and they had been raised with Christ. And so that then allows him to build on that in chapter 3, verse 1, when he says, if then you were raised with Christ. Not like he's calling it into question. He's already established that. But he's saying, since you were, here's what follows. Seek those things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. What does all that mean? Well, the old man, the self, has died. You're alive, but the life you now live is in Christ. Your life is hidden, he says, with Christ in God. What does that mean? To illustrate, it reminds me of the parable Jesus told about when he's talking about the kingdom. And he told about the woman that took the three measures to make the bread, and she mixed the yeast in it. She mixed the leaven in it. But the wording he used is that she hid the leaven in it. And of course, then you have the effect that it makes upon the mixture as she makes her bread. And so, well, where does the yeast, where does the leaven go when you're mixing it up with the other ingredients? Well, it just permeates the whole thing. It's assimilated into the whole thing. And that's what it means when it says your life is hidden. It's not talking about us hiding somewhere, but it means you are so identified with Christ. You are assimilated in Him. The life you now live, it's all about Jesus. It's like Paul said in Galatians 2:20, I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I live in the flesh, I live in the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Look at verse 4. I'm still in Colossians 3. When Christ, who is our life, appears. Now, we don't have to belabor the point to say there's a difference in something being an appendage, in something that is on the periphery. There's a difference in something, well, yeah, we do that too, and for it to be said that something is our life. If this is that by which you are defined, this is everything to you. And by the way, the last part of verse 11 says, Christ is all in all. He's everything. And with too many, it's like, well, yes, I would like that too, but it's not Christ, our life. But what I'm saying is this. I cannot separate, when I talk about the home as God would have it, when I talk about the role of fathers and husbands, I can't separate that from passages like this. And by the way, it's true that in this same chapter, Paul is going to be talking about husbands and wives and parents and children. Like in Colossians 3, verse 18, he mentions the wives. In verse 19, he mentions the husbands. In verse 20, he mentions the children. Verse 21, he mentions the fathers. But that's after he's talked about being raised with Christ, a spiritual mindset, seeking the things that are above. That's after he's talked about you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. He, verse 4, Christ is our life. He's all in all. And so again, if we say, well, I want to have the home as God would have it, but I want to skip that stuff, it won't work that way. This is the foundation upon which we must build. And again, it's not like you're raised from the watery grave of baptism and instantly here you are, full grown in the Lord, you're fully developed in all these things. It's a growth process. And that's why passages like 2 Peter 2 and 2 Peter 3, rather, in verse 18 say, but grow in grace and knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That's why passages like 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 18 talk about our being transformed as we behold as in a mirror the glory of the Lord. More and more like Jesus. So that Christ-centered life is what we're talking about. But I want to mention some specifics that are important. If you are to accept the responsibility of being a husband, the Bible teaches you must be willing to provide for your household. Now, I'm not approaching this, as you can already see, from the standpoint that this is all about money. The most important thing is how much money he makes. You can see we've been laying a foundation. But God includes this as the responsibility of the husband. You may remember that we mentioned last night, and I know not everyone was here last evening. By the way, lessons are being recorded, right, Mike? And so these will be available as you revisit and review the things we've said, and if there's a passage you didn't get and that sort of thing. But I did mention 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8, that if one does not provide for his own, and especially they of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And you may remember that I did mention last evening that when Bill Hall was addressing our young guys at leadership camp, he was telling the boys, as you make your plans for the future, select an occupation where you can serve God and it won't interfere with services and things like that, but not just pick something that you like and you want to do, to select something that you can earn a living and provide for your family. And he told our young guys that, he said, your wife may or may not work outside the home to supplement the income. But he said, don't count on that from the standpoint that it's your responsibility to provide for your family. And we can't do other things that make up for that and just skip that part. The Bible teaches about the work ethic that we are to have. In Proverbs 22, verse 29, you notice I keep referring back to the Proverbs. It says, do you see a man that excels in his work? He shall stand before kings. And I like that concept of excelling in your work. Not just watching the clock. Not just... A Christian should be excelling in his work, because whatever he sets his mind to do, he does it heartily, as unto the Lord. It's the Lord that he serves, whatever his occupation might be. Again, the Proverbs refers to the hand of the diligent. And passages such as Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Ephesians 5 and verse 25. Husbands, love your wives. As Christ loves the church, the bar is high, isn't it? And you look there in verse 29. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. The concept of nourishing and cherishing. You know, that's really what the word husband means. Do you remember the parable Jesus told in Mark chapter 12, the parable of the wicked husbandman? That word husbandman occurs a number of times. Now, in more recent translations, it'll call it vine dressers. And it's older English to say husbandman. But why would you call vine dressers husbandmen anyway? Well, that's what the word means. The husbandman takes care of the vineyard. The husbandman cares for the vines. He goes through there, and if they need trimming a little bit and dead branches and so forth, he does that. If there's a need for fertilizer, he does that, and he looks at it. And when it's he takes care of the vineyard. And so a husband is someone that takes care of the vines. And a husband is someone that takes care of his wife. He treasures his wife. He cherishes his wife. He shows affection toward his wife. He communicates with his wife. Or as it's summed up, and the Bible teaches in 1 Peter, that's a typo there. Sorry about that. That should be, if you're taking notes, that should be 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. I don't know why it is that things like that stand out when everybody, all my friends, are seeing it. And when I'm glancing over, you know, I don't see it at all. But here it is, and I saw it immediately when it projected there. But 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, I could tell you about Linda's uncle Hollis Creel. One time, you know, he was using the chalkboard. You know, he was the old school kind of preacher. Some of you may have known Hollis Creel. And he wrote his, making his points there. He could see after the lesson, he's standing in the back. That's where preachers are supposed to stand. And so he was standing in the back after the lesson, and he could see an older lady that was kind of almost derailing people and knocking them down. He could tell she's on a mission. She wanted to tell him something, and she sticks that finger in his face. "Young man, did you know you misspelled?" at whatever the word was. And he said, "Yes, ma'am, I believe you're right about that. I did misspell that." But he said, "Let me ask you this question. Can you tell me anything else I wrote on the board?" And she sort of looked down and said, "No." And he said, "Well, it seems to me that if I misspell more words, you'd remember more what I said." So I don't know if that works or not. But I think about that anyway. Maybe you'll remember the passage better. Who knows? 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. "You husbands, in like manner, dwell with your wives according to knowledge, giving honor to the weaker vessel, as being joint heirs also of the grace of life, to the end that your prayers be not hindered." Passages like this must be taken seriously. Dwell with them according to knowledge. Knowledge in this passage, I believe, means at least two things. First of all, and fundamentally, it would mean knowledge of God's Word, knowing the Word. But secondly, to dwell with your wife according to knowledge would mean knowing her, knowing her needs, being sensitive to that. Dwell with your wife according to knowledge, giving honor to her. And so again, these are passages where God, who has designed marriages, has spoken. And so many ways that we can communicate, "You are special to me. I treasure you. If you've got something to talk about, we can talk. I will always help you. I will never leave you." Various ways, whether in words or in deeds, that is communicated. I believe that is so important. But I must move on. I will tell you, there's so many things about the role of a husband that we could talk about. But the lesson is also dealing with the role of fathers as well. And so we want to talk about that as well for a few minutes this morning. Of course, God's provision for procreation, for bringing children into the world, is the home. And it is when there is that marriage where two people are eligible for marriage, they're joined together by God in marriage, and they bring children into the world. The home as God designed it. So many children are born today illegitimately. So many are born when there has not been the preparation for marriage, the scriptural thought put into it. And so here all manner of children are brought into a home that is dysfunctional to begin with. And it that bears so much fruit. Psalm 127, verses 3 through 5. "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are the children of one's youth. Happy is he who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate." And so you can see so many passages in the Old and New Testament that speak of the joy of the mother and father, husband and wife joined together by God in marriage, then being blessed with children that they have brought into the world. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Paul wrote the Thessalonians, and he had been with them. He had taught them. They had been converted by the gospel, and now he's writing them. He cares about them. They're still new converts. But he says in 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 11 and 12, "We exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his own children." Now, Paul is using that phrase as an illustration because he's not literally their father. But he cared for them. They had been begotten through the gospel. And what he had done following their begettal and their birth, their new birth into Christ and their birth into the kingdom of the Lord, what had he done? He exhorted, he comforted, he charged every one of them as a father does his children. So we learn from it, even though it's an illustration of how he's dealing with these young converts, we learn by that what a father should be doing with his children. Exhorting them, comforting them, charging them. It's a different way of like what Paul would have said, what Paul did say, I should say, in Ephesians chapter 6. When he there said that the fathers are not to provoke their children to wrath, but to bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And so there's instruction, there's discipline, there's nurture, there's admonition as we look at the role of the father with his children. And by the way, that was Ephesians 6 and verse 4. There are mistakes that should be avoided by those of us who are fathers. Sometimes one's own children can be used to take care of one's own unmet needs. Sometimes there's not a good relationship with one's spouse. And so children are brought into the discussion, and sometimes they're put into the middle of things, and they're told things that a child shouldn't have to be burdened with, and grown-up things that... And sometimes parents make a mistake in that. They're having trouble with their marriage, so they pull in a child that's close to them, and that's not healthy. That's not good. And sometimes fathers just really aren't there. Not only when they're out making a living, but even when they're home, they're not really there for their family. And that, again, everyone pays a high price for that. And so we could list any number of mistakes to be avoided. But in a positive way, I want to talk about some things that I want us to keep in mind in the time that we have remaining. Here's an expression that I want to give you the context on this. Trying to build a boy. It's sad to me that I don't think anybody in here besides Linda knows or knew Raymond Harville. Raymond died several years ago. He was, when we first met him back in 1976, he was up in Middle Tennessee. And such a good man, a faithful gospel preacher, and one of the best friends that I've ever had. I learned so much from him. And he was just old enough, barely, to have been my father. And he looked on me, sometimes as a brother, but sometimes like as I were his son. And he saw when each of our children were born. He was there and saw them growing up, and he wouldn't hesitate. We were, as I say, we were close, and he wouldn't hesitate to say, you know, you need to be spending time with Linda. Take her out. He'd say, I was training a bird dog, and that's back when there used to be quail, which was a long time ago. But I was training a bird dog, and I like to take that bird dog out and go hunting. And he said, you'll have time later on to do some of that. He said, spend time with those children now. But anyway, getting back to trying to build a boy, he said, while Raymond was still very much alive and at himself, I asked his permission to tell this story. And he said, I could. But one of the things he said was that, he said, I don't want you to make the mistakes I made. He said, when my son was little, I was interested in rebuilding cars. But he said, I didn't have a regular workshop. It was just kind of in the carport area and didn't have a lot of room and didn't have a fancy lift. So he'd have a jack up there, just confined little bit of space. And so his son would be up there wanting to do something with his dad, and there wouldn't be room. And well... you know, son, I don't have room here. Back up just a little bit. And so the next thing you know, he'd pick up a tool that Raymond had and walk off with it. You know how little kids do. And so here he was, and the tools are. And so it's like, here, give me that tool. I need that. And go on in and see what your mother's doing. And he said, after a while, he thought, what am I doing? He said, I'm not trying to build a car. I'm trying to build a boy. But he had lost sight of it. He was just acknowledging for the time being he had lost sight of that. And I don't know how many times that as we were, of course, our children are up and gone and have been gone for some time. Now we're still very much involved and concerned with them. But now the grandchildren have come along. But I don't know how many times as our children were still in the home and growing up, Linda would say, remember, you're trying to raise a boy. And there were times I'd be frustrated and lose sight of that, and I needed to call that to mind. By the way, when do you start trying to raise a boy? When does that process begin? We have three children. When Seth was born, up in Murray County, Tennessee, at the hospital there, Linda and I, it was late at night, and we were looking at him in his little tiny bassinet. And you see, at the congregation where we were at the time, not where we are now, but where we had been, there was a woman that had determined to put away her husband without a scriptural cause. She just didn't want to be in that marriage anymore, and we tried to work with her, but no. So we were very upset because of that broken home, the divorce that had just occurred. So here we are, we're looking at Seth, newborn Seth. He may have been out of the womb by an hour by then. You know, he's cleaned up, he's there in the little bassinet. And so we're looking at him together. And Linda says, Seth, don't ever divorce. And always be a faithful Christian. Now, as I say, he's 1 hour old. And I wasn't sure at the time how much he got out of that. But I do know that that's what he was taught from the time he was born. Now what happens is you have to make the faith your own. And Seth has done that, and now he's a faithful gospel preacher. But what I'm saying is you don't start what I'm talking about later on when one's a teenager and say, hey, we need to talk. It's something that you should start immediately. Well, let me share some things about that. Some passages that I want to consider with you. For example, in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5, Paul writes Timothy and says, when I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother, Lois, and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded in you also. The thing I like about this passage is, Paul says, I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you. Now, it's one thing to say, I've got a Bible. I've got a copy of the Scriptures. That's good. It's one thing to say, my parents are faithful Christians. That's good. But it's another thing to say that the genuine faith is in me. I've internalized it. I've made it my own. I appreciate those who have taught me, but I don't believe because they've taught me merely. I believe because I've studied, I've considered, I've looked at it from every angle. I've made the faith my own. It's genuine faith that dwells in me. I'm using the first person to illustrate. That's what Paul is talking about here for Timothy. That's what Timothy had done. That's what we must all do to make the faith our own. Now, why am I saying that? Because as parents, as fathers, that's our goal. That there's a time to say, do this because I say so. Do this because I'm your dad. I told you that. But the goal that we have, it goes beyond that. The goal is that the genuine faith will be in that son or daughter, as the case may be. It's kind of like, by the way, in that same chapter, just a couple of verses down, in 2 Timothy 1, I'm thinking of 1 Timothy, the first chapter, where in verse 5, 1 Timothy 1 and verse 5, the purpose of the commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. And so we're keeping that in mind. That's the purpose that God has in mind. So genuine faith. But there's something else. In 1 Peter 3 and verse 15, the Apostle Peter said that we are to sanctify the Lord God in our hearts. Always be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Sometimes people look at this passage and say we should be able to give a defense of what we believe. And that's true. And people say you need to know what you believe and why you believe it. And that's true. You need to be able to give scriptures, scriptural reasons for why you do what you do. And I agree with that. But what he's really saying is a reason for the hope. A reason for the hope that is in you. What is really envisioned here in this passage is not just someone saying, hey, I've noticed you folks at Garden City break unleavened bread on the first day of the week and drink the fruit of the vine. Why do you do that? Now, see, that's a good question. And we need to be able to answer a question like that. But again, that's not what is primary in this verse. He's not just thinking of why do you do what you do. He says the hope. The hope that is in you. In other words, what is envisioned is people at school, people at work are observing you. And they're seeing, he doesn't use bad language like other people do. He doesn't blast everybody out and lose his temper and have outbursts of wrath like these others do. He doesn't join in if there's petty gossip going on. And instead of being up and down all the time, he seems to have a joy that if bad things are happening, he retains that joy. If good things are happening, he's stable. And so the point is that here's someone that'll eventually be saying, I've noticed you're different. What is it that you have that I don't have? Someone that's asking about the hope that is in you. Not just what do you believe that's different, but what about the hope that is in you? You see in 1 Peter 1 and verse 4, we've been begotten again through the resurrection of Jesus Christ unto a living hope that is undefiled, incorruptible, that fades not away, reserved in heaven for you. A living hope. 1 John chapter 3 says, everyone that has this hope set on him purifies himself, even as he is pure. And so not being moved away from the hope of the gospel, clinging to our hope. And so here's something that makes us different, and someone is asking you, tell me about that. And you have the opportunity to say what's made the difference is Jesus Christ. What has made the difference is the gospel. And so to talk about the hope that is in you. And see, that's what our goal should be as dads. So that we are instilling that living hope, that we're teaching that, we're living that ourselves, and we're showing the importance. The most important thing is for you to go to heaven. That's our hope. Hold on to that no matter what. And so the hope that is in you. John would write in 3 John to his beloved Gaius, and he would say, I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth. At our breakfast yesterday morning, following breakfast at our study, I mentioned to the guys that there were 5 books in the Bible that just have 1 chapter. This is one of them. And we made the observation just because of short books doesn't mean there's not much to it. There's a lot to it. And in 3 John, there's such an emphasis on truth. And the thing I like about what John says to Gaius is the truth that is in you. These are passages, brethren, that I have in mind when I think in terms of what God wants a father to be. He's wanting to help the child make the faith his own, the hope his own. The truth is his own. It's the truth that is in you. When Thomas saw the resurrected Christ, after he had said, I won't believe unless I put my finger in his hand and thrust my hand into his side, and the next Sunday, Jesus appeared to all of them and said, Thomas, come and see. And Thomas answered, my Lord and my God. And he's talking about Jesus Christ. And here again, there's a difference in saying there is a God. I believe there is a God. I believe Jesus is the Son of God. That's good. But to move to the point that He is my Lord, He is my God, that's our goal. And as we said last evening, as we said of Peter and John, to be like Jesus. So that's what the child has in mother and dad. Right now we're talking about the dad. And I'll conclude with this passage. Remember what I said last night about controlling self? Self-control? That's so important as parents. That's so important for us as fathers and husbands. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules the spirit than he who takes a city. Actually, I did want to mention the matter of study in Proverbs 15, verse 28, that the heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours forth evil. And so the time that is involved, and finally, the matter of prayer. And I wanted to conclude with something that is very meaningful to me. In my office, there hangs a framed poem written in calligraphy, given to me by my wife when our first son, I don't know, was maybe less than 2 years old. It's called A Father's Prayer. Perhaps you've heard of it. Dear God, my little boy of three has said his nightly prayer to thee. Before his eyes were closed in sleep, he asked that thou his soul would keep. And I, still kneeling at his bed, my hand upon his tousled head, do ask with deep humility that thou, dear Lord, remember me. Make me, kind Lord, a worthy dad, that I may lead this little lad in pathways ever fair and bright, that I may keep his steps aright. O God, his trust must never be destroyed or even marred by me. Let Christ in all my actions shine to guide this little lamb of thine. So for the simple things he prayed, with childish voice so unafraid, I trembling ask the same from thee. Dear Lord, kind Lord, remember me. Brethren, except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain who build it. May God bless us with good homes, with good fathers and husbands to guide our homes. Thank you.